House on Piccadilly, where it remains, and where Joshua Reynolds' statue has pride of place in the courtyard. Built in the early 1660s, Burlington House was bought by the British government in 1854 and rented to the Royal Academy for £1 per year. Like Somerset House, it's opulent. Every summer, the Academy holds an exhibition of works it considers the nation's best, an uninterrupted tradition that's now more than 250 years old. Anybody who wants to submit works for the summer show may do so, and competition is intense. In my lifetime, there's been a wide variety of styles rather than a prevailing orthodoxy. So the works chosen from year to year are diverse. Part of the pleasure of going to the Royal Academy's summer exhibition is overhearing the remarks of other visitors, sometimes delighted, but more often scornful. I particularly enjoy going with my sister, who is an artist, and my daughter, who's an art historian. They're quick to point out merit in works that leave me cold, but equally quick to criticize work that seems to them inferior. Reynolds's great rival as a society portraitist was Thomas Gainsborough. He was born in Sudbury, Suffolk, youngest of nine children, in a house that is now dedicated to commemorating his life and work. After early struggles to establish his reputation, he settled in Bath in 1759, where he was soon able to command high fees. He too was a founding member of the Royal Academy, but had a bumpy relationship with its leaders, periodically withdrawing his work from the annual exhibitions. His London home, Schomberg House on Pall Mall, whose facade is preserved, was grand enough by the last decades of his life that he could hold exhibitions of his own work there instead. Although Gainsborough's most lucrative work was in portraits, he had a lifelong interest in landscape and innovated in finding ways to mix the two. His double portrait of Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, for example, shows a prosperous landowner and his wife in the midst of their estates. Two-thirds of the canvas is devoted to the landscape rather than the sitters. Similarly, his portrait of Anne, Countess of Chesterfield, situates her not indoors with her possessions, but in a recess of her garden. The Gainsborough House in Sudbury was already 200 years old when the future artist was born. His family modified it, adding a new facade, before going bankrupt when Thomas was nine. In the house today is a fine collection of his prints and drawings, several portraits, many letters, his artist's equipment, including a set of bladders used for storing paint, and his library of books on artistic taste and technique. Its walled garden adds to the appeal of the house, which has been a museum since 1961. In the late 18th century and through the 19th, the status of landscape paintings, previously rather modest, increased. This change was attributable partly to the Reverend William Gilpin. Gilpin had definite ideas about what sort of landscape was desirable or picturesque and what was not. He encouraged the era's growing number of pleasure-seeking travellers, especially those who wanted to sketch, to take along framed, tinted mirrors known as clawed glasses. When they came to an attractive view, they should turn their backs on it and look at its reflection in the mirror, adjusting their position and that of the mirror until the components inside the frame were balanced and harmonious. "These glasses," he wrote, "give the object of nature a soft, mellow tinge, like the colouring of that master." The master in question was the French 17th century painter Claude Lorrain. The right kind of picture, Gilpin believed, would have a dark foreground, a vivid middle ground containing some interesting object, like a ruined castle or abbey, and then a less clearly defined far distance. There ought not to be straight lines or symmetry. He also took the view that nature was rarely good enough and that artists should help it by inserting trees and other objects where necessary, making reality conform to the theory rather than vice versa. He even suggested that Tintern Abbey in the Wye Valley was not quite ruined enough and that a few blows with a mallet would help move it along toward the ideal of picturesqueness. Despite satirical reactions from Jane Austen, among others, Gilpin's ideas caught on and were encouraged by other artists. Late 18th century aesthetics distinguished between the sublime and the beautiful. Sublime scenes and paintings induced fear and awe in the viewer. The Alps, the Scottish Highlands, or Gilpin's own Lake District were suitable locations for the sublime. Beautiful scenes, by contrast, were of soft, gentle environments, the kind more likely to be encountered in southern and eastern England. The greatest landscape painter of southern England was John Constable. Born in East Burgholt, Suffolk, just a few miles east of Gainsborough's home, he came of age during the Napoleonic Wars, and unlike most of his predecessors, did not go on a grand tour of France and Italy. Instead, he concentrated on what he knew best, the landscape around his Suffolk home at Flatford Mill in the Dedham Vale. He was not particularly interested in historical, religious, or mythological themes. His best-known works are landscapes, notably Dedham Vale, Boat Building near Flatford Mill, The Hay Wain, and The Lock. They caught on more quickly in France than England. Constable's reputation gained ground only slowly at home, and he became a member of the Royal Academy only at the age of 52. Flatford remains today a rustic village in Dedham Vale. The National Trust, which manages several of the principal buildings, is exaggerating only slightly when it claims, "Wandering beside the River Stour, or looking at Flatford Mill, you can feel as if you're actually walking through one of Constable's paintings." The mill that Constable's father operated is still there, now a protected building. The house visible on the left in The Hay Wain is also still there, albeit looking smarter now than it did in 1821. The lock on the River Stour, featured in The Lock, remains, as does the dry dock where Boat Building was painted. While in Constable country, you can visit a low-ceilinged thatched cottage, rent a canoe to paddle along the River Stour, or follow a few of the easy public footpaths in this recently designated area of outstanding natural beauty. Two renowned Constable landscapes from other parts of the country are his painting Salisbury Cathedral from the Bishop's Ground and his watercolour of Stonehenge, both now in the Victoria and Albert Museum. An important development of the early 19th century in Britain was the vogue for landscapes in watercolour. The advantage, from the artist's point of view, was that they could be finished much more quickly than oils, an important consideration for men who needed to produce and sell enough works to make a living. It was also easier for them to work out of doors from the life, because it required the movement of less bulky equipment. Constable's contemporary, Thomas Girton, was among the first specialist watercolourists of the landscape. His painting, Jedburgh Abbey from the South East, conforms closely to Gilpin's ideas about the picturesque, featuring a dark foreground and a grand ruin at its centre. It and his watercolours of the Abbey ruins at Lindisfarne, an island off the coast of northeast England, are architecturally precise and give us a good idea of the degree the dilapidation of the ruins had reached by about 1800. One of Girton's friends as a teenager was Joseph Turner, his exact contemporary, who later remarked that he would never have made his own reputation if Girton had not died young. His Tintern Abbey, 1795, is very similar in style and content to Girton's Lindisfarne. Turner was a master of the Gilpin and Girton style, but gradually became more adventurous, using swirls of colour to create a feeling of movement. Championed by the art critic John Ruskin, he emerged as a major landscape artist, while creating works that sometimes gestured towards abstraction. In relatively conventional style, his 1818 painting of Raby Castle follows Gilpin by having the great structure in the middle distance, behind a dark foreground, A sky that Constable could equally have painted shows blustery clouds, a distant rainstorm, and glimpses of blue. Far more daring in style and content is Rain, Steam and Speed from 1844. A railway train, then something new in the world, is crossing a river bridge, approaching the viewer, in a setting that is smudged, lacking all detail, and slashed by diagonals that suggest heavy rain. Art historians believe that the setting was the bridge across the Thames at Maidenhead. Even more dramatic is Snowstorm, Steamboat off a harbour's mouth, in which the swirling storm dominates and the boat can scarcely be recognised. The literary critic William Hazlitt called Turner the painter of nothing. The recently opened Turner Contemporary Art Gallery in Margate, Kent, stands on the site of a boarding house where he used to visit the landlady, Mrs. Sophie Booth, who was also his mistress. It's a vast space inside a series of angular white concrete boxes designed by David Chipperfield. Turner originals are too expensive for the museum to possess any, but travelling exhibitions often feature them. And the gallery has become the centrepiece of an attempt to revitalise a seaside town in decline. In a recent nationwide poll for Britain's best painting, Turner's The Fighting Temeraire was the winner. It shows a veteran ship from the Battle of Trafalgar being towed to the breaker's yard by a steam tug at sunset. A measure of its iconic status is the fact that, beginning in 2020, it will be the image on British £20 notes. Moving into the second half of the 19th century, I'd like now to turn to William Morris, the central figure in the arts and crafts movement. Critical of industrialisation, he believed that mechanisation had degraded work, which ought to be man's most dignified activity. He also hated it for the smoke and dirt it generated, ideas well expressed in his 1868 poem, The Earthly Paradise, which begins like this. Forget six counties overhung with smoke. Forget the snorting steam and piston stroke. Forget the spreading of the hideous town. Think rather of the pack horse on the down, and dream of London small and white and clean, the clear Thames bordered by its gardens green. This dislike of industry and its effects was widely shared by Victorian artists, notably the Pre-Raphaelites and Gothic Revival architects like Augustus Pugin. Morris aimed to restore the dignity of labour through handicrafts, working on fabric, wallpaper, furniture and embroidery to his own designs. Morris came from a wealthy family, but became an idealistic socialist of the non-violent, non-Marxist variety. Ironically, the customers for his handmade materials were nearly always from the upper middle class. Workers could not afford them, because he could not achieve the economies of scale that bring down prices with mass production. In 1871, he and the Pre-Raphaelite artist Dante Gabriel Rossetti moved into Kelmscott Manor at Lechlade in the Cotswolds. A 17th century house, previously occupied by a prosperous farming family, they turned it into a treasure house of their paintings, drawings, tapestries, ceramics, carpets, metalwork, wallpapers, furniture and glass. It's now a museum, equally impressive as a building and as a space for the collections. The exposed timbers in the attic and several lower rooms, the garden dovecots, and the carefully tended gardens, all now curated by the Society of Antiquaries, make it a living testament to Morris's anti-industrial ideas. It's possible and appropriate to approach Kelmscott on foot along the Thames Path, which follows the river from its headwaters all the way to the sea. After 1900, modern artists began to break out of conventional genres, experimenting with new materials and new approaches to the setting of artworks. Several British sculptors worked on a large scale with abstract shapes, of whom Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth are the most prominent. Both came from Yorkshire. Moore was a coal miner's son from Castleford. His parents were determined that he not become a miner, And at first they didn't like the idea of sculpture as a career because it seemed too much like manual labour. He prevailed over their objections and became a multimillionaire, one of the premier sculptors in the world. His works are mostly semi-abstract, reminiscent of human figures, while sometimes dramatically distorted. Many are of reclining nudes or mother and child pairings. By 1970, they were placed prominently outside the House of Lords in London and outside the West German government buildings in Bonn. Numerous world-class museums also positioned his monumental abstract works beside their entrances. The garden of Moore's house, Hoglands, in Hertfordshire, the Hertfordshire village of Perry Green, is the best place to see a cluster of his works all in the same place, unless you're lucky enough to catch a special retrospective exhibition. He wrote that, "I would rather have a piece of my sculpture put in a landscape, almost any landscape, than in or on the most beautiful building I know." Among the works displayed at Perry Green is Double Oval, which can be viewed as a pure abstract or as a pair of human faces. Other Moore works are on display at the Henry Moore Institute in Leeds, Yorkshire, adjacent to the city's art gallery, in a set of converted 19th century merchants' houses. Barbara Hepworth came from Wakefield and was a friendly rival of Moore for much of their lifetime. They met in Leeds when both were students in 1920. Her massive abstract sculptures in the 1940s and 50s appealed to corporate and government clients, including the United Nations in New York City. In 2011, a museum dedicated to her work opened in Wakefield, her hometown, adjacent to the Calder River. The building fits the work. It's a stark series of concrete trapezoids, reminiscent of a three-dimensional cubist painting. The exhibits inside give a good sense of Hepworth's range and include over 40 of the full-size plaster and aluminum models, or prototypes, from which the bronzes were subsequently cast. For several decades before her death in 1975, Hepworth lived in St. Ives, Cornwall. In another lecture of this series, I say more about her studio and garden there, which are also museums. In the 1970s, the idea of sculpture parks caught on. Two good examples are Grisdale in the Lake District and the Yorkshire Sculpture Park near Wakefield. In 1977, the Grisdale Society began to site sculptures along the paths of a forest area near to Coniston Water. By now, there are 90 of them. To see them, hike, ride a mountain bike through the woods, where you'll come upon them blended into the landscape. One of the most amusing is Alana Robbins' 1995 sculpture, Lady of the Water. The artist diverted a stream into a high wooden flume. Holding it up is the elongated figure of a woman with her arms stretched into the air. The water flows straight onto the head of a second figure, similarly elongated, directly facing her. It creates the impression that they're cooperating in getting cleaned up, or perhaps that one is being baptized by the other. Another striking work is Some Fern by Kerry Morrison, which looks like a giant insect with wings made from ferns. The 500 acres of the Yorkshire Sculpture Park are in less rugged country, and here the sculptures sit on lawns rather than in a forest. The park is situated on the estate of an 18th century mansion, Breton Hall, and still includes follies commissioned by the original owner. Most of the works are recent, including sculptures by Moore and Hepworth, but with a large variety of temporary works by other artists, which change from year to year. The old estate chapel has been converted into an indoor gallery, and four other spaces have been created to present indoor exhibitions. Monumental objects often become shorthand ways to identify places, as with the Eiffel Tower in Paris, or the statue of Christ the Redeemer that overlooks Rio de Janeiro. An example in Britain is the Angel of the North, a steel sculpture on a hilltop in the town of Gateshead near Newcastle-on-Tyne. Designed by Anthony Gormley, it is 65 feet high and has a wingspan of 175 feet. and is anchored by hundreds of tons of reinforced concrete to withstand high winds. It was placed there in 1998 amid controversy, with some local people loving it, others deploring it. 20 years later, it's withstood the critics and is becoming iconic. The main road approaching Newcastle is the A1, and as you drive north, you see the angel ahead of you for several miles. Its outstretched wings look more like those of a glider. There's no sign of feathers. In fact, the work could be taken as a parody of Paul Landowski's Christ at Rio de Janeiro. Gormley also created Another Place, which consists of 100 life-size nude male figures, modelled on his own body, that are spread over a large area of Crosby Beach, Liverpool, all facing out to sea. When the tide comes in, they're covered. As it goes out, leaving a vast flat, they are exposed. Public reactions have been mixed with this work too, and Gormley had to campaign hard to keep them there. Judgments of what is good and what is bad in modern art are certain to continue. Let me put in a sympathetic word for one of the oddest recent works of sculpture, which I know about because I'm a railway enthusiast. This is a larger-than-life-size model of the steam locomotive Mallard, the fastest steam train in world history, which was clocked at 126 miles per hour in 1938. The city of Darlington, site of the world's first public steam railway, commissioned the Scottish sculptor David Mack to build it in 1997. It's made of red brick. A team of 34 bricklayers laboured for nearly 6 months to finish it. It even includes billows of smoke pouring from the locomotive's chimney, which have also been captured in undulating brickwork. It appears to be rushing out of a tunnel in the form of a grassy bank, on top of which stands a viewing platform. Mack specialises in industrial materials. His Out of Order is a line of red telephone boxes at Kingston-on-Thames that are falling over like a line of dominoes. These and many others of Mack's work are irresistibly amusing, at least to me. Finally, look at the way the artist Grayson Perry has used his unusual personal life as an advertisement for his art. Always aiming to outrage his audiences, sometimes dressing in drag, he's also a skillful designer and painter, especially of ceramics. His work, A House for Essex, is literally a house in the Essex village of Rabness, brilliantly coloured and filled with Perry's work in other media. He imagined it as a chapel built by a grieving husband on the death of his wife, Julie. She has died in a freak accident hit by a fast food delivery motorcycle, which has been salvaged and now hangs from the ceiling of the living room. From the outside, it's slightly reminiscent of a church, maybe even a Russian Orthodox church, covered with brightly patterned green and white tiles, arched windows, and bulging roof ornaments, with a golden roof. Inside, the sense of overwhelming colour persists, with brilliant red and yellow chairs, bright paintings and tapestries, and a skull mosaic in the foyer. A company named Living Architecture, brainchild of an eccentric philosopher, rents it out for a few nights at a time to people interested in actually living in highly unusual architectural environments. It's further evidence that the creative impulse is thriving in contemporary Britain, as much outside the conventional galleries as within. One of the many pleasures of wandering through provincial Britain is to encounter, unexpectedly, inventive works of contemporary art or landscape sculpture. They vary in quality, just as contemporary audiences' tastes vary. I try to be open-minded and to admit that the bafflement I sometimes feel might well be a sign of my limitations, rather than the limitations of the works themselves.
Lecture 30, Britain's Estates and Gardens.
Ever since the invention of agriculture, humans have been modifying the landscape, mostly in order to grow their own food and manage domestic animals. Sometimes they've modified the land for aesthetic reasons too, turning it into a source of enjoyment. We call the result gardens. Britain is full of them. Its mild, wet climate is well suited to a vast array of flowers, herbs, bushes and trees, indigenous and imported. The history of English gardening is imprecise before about 1500, because we have so few records. From that time forward, there's a steady increase of interest in and description of British gardening and landscape. Two of the earliest gardens that can still be seen in something approximating their original form are the Botanic Gardens at Oxford University and the Chelsea Physic Garden in London. The former, Oxford, dates back to 1621, when the Earl of Danby donated the money for a physic garden at Oxford. In other words, a garden in which medicinal plants could be grown and studied. It's still there today in a beautiful spot adjacent to Magdalen College, the Charwell River, and Christchurch Meadow. You enter through a magnificent archway, the Danby Gate, with statues of Danby himself and two kings, Charles I and Charles II. Inside are extensive displays of tropical plants in glasshouses, a bog garden occupying low-lying land beside the River Charwell, a long herbaceous border, and changing displays from year to year, depending on the curator's current interests. Last time I was there, one display was of plants already present in the garden by 1648, when a detailed inventory was taken. Geometric walks are punctuated by fountains, and the formal rigour of some areas is offset by a carefully controlled wildness elsewhere. Today, it's as much a place of beauty and relaxation as a place for scientific study. In summer, the artfully designed borders, especially those backing up to the old stone walls, are spectacular. Right outside the Danby Gate is a rose garden, a blaze of white, red and yellow blooms every summer. The Chelsea Physic Garden in London was founded in 1673 by the Worshipful Society of Apothecaries. It had a similar function to the Oxford Garden, to be a concentration of medicinal plants. It's been open to the public since the 1980s and includes the oldest rock garden in Britain. It was also a seed exchange. From Chelsea, cotton plants were first introduced into the British colony of Georgia. And for more than a century, it had the most diverse collection of plant species in Britain. In the early 1700s, a vogue began for landscape gardening, especially among members of the upper classes with big estates. Louis XIV and his great palace of Versailles had imitators in England. One example is the gardens at Rest Park in Bedfordshire, laid out in rigorously geometric patterns by George London and Henry Wise for the Duke of Kent. Rest includes a long canal that leads to a Baroque pavilion built in 1711 and fronted by a statue of King William III. There's also an orangery, very fashionable among the 18th century elite when few oranges were imported, and most Britons never had the chance to eat one in their entire lives. Sadly, oranges are no longer being grown there. Those from English hothouses can't compete with the much tastier ones coming in from Spain, Israel and Florida. The house at Rest is much newer than the gardens, which have themselves been modified over the centuries, but still carry the original geometric design. In the early 1700s, however, an influential group of innovators guided garden design in a different direction. The first celebrity designer was William Kent. He collaborated with the Duke of Burlington in designing Chiswick House and Gardens in the 1720s, blending formal elements, such as straight avenues of trees, with rolling meadows, lakes, and classical temples. In another lecture from this series, I spoke about Chiswick House and its estate in more detail. Kent later became head gardener at Stowe House in Buckinghamshire, whose gardens still bear the imprint of his work. Stowe is full of references to the classics, including a Doric arch from the 1760s, built in honor of George II's daughter Amelia, and a Corinthian arch from the same decade. A pair of pavilions in the form of Greek temples stand beside the lake, while a circular temple of ancient virtue shines in the morning sun. In its four niches are statues of Homer, Socrates, Lycurgus, and Epaminondas, who Kent considered the greatest poet, philosopher, lawgiver, and soldier of ancient Greece. Its counterpart, catching the afternoon sun, is Kent's Temple of British Worthies, which declares by its presence that Britain has men and women worthy to stand side by side with the great figures of the ancient world. It's a long stone structure with a small pyramid at its centre and 16 niches, each with its own bust. Some of the people represented, like Isaac Newton, Queen Elizabeth I, and Alfred the Great, would appear on many people's best of British lists, even today. Others, like Thomas Gresham and John Barnard, important politicians at the time, are now forgotten by all but the experts. The gardens at Stowe also include a lovely Palladian bridge from the 1740s, copied from an original at Wilton House, and itself later imitated by other aristocrats. There's a comparable collection of garden buildings at Stourhead in Wiltshire, built in stages through the 18th century, mainly by Francis Cartwright and Nathaniel Ireson. Walking a footpath from the house down to the perimeter of the estate's artificial lake was supposed to recreate Aeneas's journey into the underworld. It's fun to take this hike today. I did it in 2017. As you move through the half-wooded landscape, your eye catches glimpses of elaborate temples as you turn corners or reach open vistas. Among the buildings are a Pantheon, best seen across the lake. There's also an Italian Renaissance-style grotto that includes the statue of a sleeping nymph. By the time you've hiked around the lake, you'll be tempted to miss the stiff climb up to the temple of the sun god Apollo, but resist the temptation because this temple is delightful inside and out. A couple of miles away, at a remote corner of the Stourhead estate, there's also a great tower in memory of King Alfred the Great. Money was no problem for Stourhead's owner, Henry Hoare. He was nicknamed Henry the Magnificent, and at one point bought a medieval cross from the city of Bristol, shipped it to Stourhead, and resited it there. Meanwhile, William Kent acquired a talented apprentice, Lancelot Capability Brown, who eventually outstripped his master in influence. Brown's big idea was to create the illusion of a natural landscape through artificial means, enhancing a house's environment and making it more scenic while avoiding straight lines and geometric patterns. He was affable, outgoing, and radiated an air of trustworthiness. Members of the British aristocracy hired him in large numbers. He also knew how to work hard and efficiently, with the result that his handiwork is still visible in many parts of Britain, an estimated 170 parks. The great parks at Kedleston and Chatsworth in Derbyshire were landscaped by Brown. So were those at Blenheim, Warwick Castle and Althorp, home of the Spencer family. In 1764, he also became master gardener to King George III at Hampton Court. The distinctive mark of a Capability Brown estate, fully on display at Kedleston, was a blend of open meadows, sinuously curving serpentine lakes, and a horizon marked by clumps or lines of trees, including cedars of Lebanon. A tasteful classical bridge attracts the eye, spanning the artificial lake at its narrow point. The rich families that employed Brown sometimes moved entire villages and rerouted roads if they interfered with the park's design. When Brown's work was complete, there'd be no sign of roads or villages from the house, or from the avenues that wound among the grounds. He offered his patrons the illusion of total seclusion, even when their wealth was based on renting the majority of their land to hard-working tenant farmers. These great estates sometimes included herds of deer. A law passed in the 1720s made it illegal to buy and sell venison. As a result, the only people who could eat it were deer park owners and their guests, it became one of the surest marks of elite status. Brown's reputation at the time, and since, has always been mixed. To some contemporaries, he was the great genius who created the distinctively English look of country parks, the Shakespeare of gardening. To his detractors, he annihilated a delightful variety of older gardens, created a uniform and monotonous style, and left little room for decoration and flowers. Sir William Chambers wrote that, "A stranger is often at a loss to know whether he is walking in a meadow or in a pleasure ground made and kept at very considerable expense." The National Trust addresses this problem with a webpage on how to spot a capability brown landscape. Despite criticisms like these, Capability Brown made an immense fortune. He bought a grand country estate of his own, Fenstanton Manor, in Huntingdonshire. And his children moved into the circles of the British elite, one becoming an admiral. His successor was Humphrey Repton, the man who coined the expression landscape gardener. A talented painter, Repton offered customers watercolours showing before and after views of estates, and emphasising how much better he could make them. His handiwork is on display at Woburn Abbey in Bedfordshire, about 50 miles northwest of London. Where Brown had let the meadows roll right up to the stately house, Repton introduced themed gardens. At Woburn, one is Chinese, another is an arboretum with diverse exotic species. There's even a thornery, a concentration of thorny plants and bushes, influenced by his era's vogue for the picturesque, which I mentioned in the lecture on painting. Repton recited approach roads to add drama, and sometimes cut swathes through woodland to disclose views of distant church spires or hilltops. Repton was a contemporary of Jane Austen, whose Mansfield Park includes an interesting conversation about him and his work. A Mr. Rushworth comes to Mansfield after visiting Compton, the home of his friend Mr. Smith, who's been transforming his estate. Rushworth tells the company, "I wish you could see Compton. It's the most complete thing. I never saw a place so altered in my life. The approach now is one of the finest things in the country." When he says he wants to transform his own estate, another character tells him, "Your best friend on such an occasion would be Mr. Repton, I imagine." Rushworth agrees. "Smith's place is the admiration of all the country, and it was a mere nothing before Repton took it in hand. I think I shall have Repton." Skillful manipulation of the landscape was one direction in estate management. Another was the gathering of specimens from around the world for study and amusement. This impulse can best be seen at work in London's Kew Gardens, which were founded by the royal family in the 1750s and became important after 1770. Their curator in those days was Joseph Banks, a leading scientist who travelled to the Pacific with Captain James Cook. They brought back hundreds of plant species previously unknown in Britain, and Banks cultivated as many of them as possible at Kew. He made Kew preeminent in the world as a place to which exotic specimens could be brought or sent. 20 years of neglect followed his death in 1820, but the gardens were refounded in 1840 and have thrived ever since. More than 30,000 species are on display, most in the open air, some in great hothouses. One prominent feature is a pseudo-oriental pagoda over 150 feet high and a sensation when completed in 1762. Early observers doubted that it could stand. A second spectacle is the Japanese Gateway, built as a symbol of Anglo-Japanese friendship in 1910, and now surrounded by an elaborate Japanese-style peace garden. Kew includes a palm house, built in 1844, to far grander specifications than any glass house up to that time, and perfectly expressing the mid-Victorian excitement with the possibilities of iron frames and plate glass. More recent additions at Kew include a treetop walk and a conservatory that was opened by Princess Diana in 1987 and now bears her name. I can't recommend Kew Gardens too highly. Even if you think you're not an enthusiast for plants and trees, you'll find a day there informative and enjoyable. If you go to only one garden during your visit to Britain, let it be this one. In the 19th century, a reaction set in against the style of Capability Brown and Humphrey Repton. Some owners revived the more formal French and Italian style of garden design. Trentham Gardens near Stoke-on-Trent is a characteristic example. Its formal gardens, Italian in style, were laid out in 1840 by Charles Barry, the architect of the Houses of Parliament. My only visit in recent years, in 2016, was in pelting rain, but even then the brightness and precision of the design made it a great pleasure. Stoke-on-Trent was the centre of the pottery industry, and ironically the owners of Trentham, the Dukes of Sutherland, finally abandoned the place because the pollution of its air and water was so appalling. As a result, the site now contains only the ruins of the great house, whereas the gardens have been fully restored and never looked better. The most influential gardener of the 19th century was Joseph Paxton. He began his career at Chiswick House in London, where the 6th Duke of Devonshire noticed his work and brought him to his great country estate, Chatsworth, in Derbyshire. There, Paxton built a series of imposing glass houses to keep alive tropical plants that could not survive the English winter. Spending tens of thousands of pounds while experimenting with iron-framed and plate-glass structures comparable to the Palm House at Kew. The era enjoyed a craze for growing bananas and pineapples, which in Britain's damp and chilly climate only the owners of glass houses could hope to accomplish. In 1844, anticipating a visit from the Tsar of Russia, the Duke asked Paxton to create a great fountain, the Emperor. Chatsworth sits in the valley of the River Derwent and is fed by streams flowing down the valley side. In the 1690s, a French engineer had taken advantage of this topography to create a cascade that flows down a series of steps from a fanciful domed temple. Paxton, to create high water pressure for the fountain, dammed another of the hillside streams, then channeled water from the reservoir it created into a narrow pipe. The result was a high-pressure fountain that shot 260 feet or more into the air, easily the highest in the world up to that time. The Tsar never visited, but the fountain survives in the middle of a beautiful rectangular pool adjacent to the house. Another 19th century achievement was the Heligan Gardens of Mavagissi, now known as the Lost Gardens of Heligan. The mild climate of Cornwall, England's most southwesterly county, enables many tropical plants to survive the winter out of doors. And the Tremaine family that designed Heligan took advantage of species that would have perished elsewhere. They gathered a wide variety of rhododendrons and camellias and a garden dedicated to imported Japanese species. Heligan required 22 full-time gardeners. During World War I, however, 16 of the 22 were killed in the trenches. The others could not cope, and after the war, the estate's discouraged owner moved away to Italy. Only in the 1990s did restoration begin, thanks to the work of a record producer, Tim Smith, who was also the mastermind of the nearby Eden Project. The garden had disappeared under mountains of creeping vines and fallen trees, but has now been largely recovered. The restoration drew nationwide attention and a sympathetic 6-part television show. A large crew of gardeners now works at Heligan to grow food in a productive garden, while others are continuing to reclaim the wilder areas, one of which features a swaying rope bridge and is known as the jungle. Resident artists create earth sculptures, and the gardeners themselves are happy to show themselves at work, emphasizing the relationship between people, plants, and climate, rather than aiming for an artificial perfection. Heligan is the place to see just how much hard work is involved in reviving a neglected garden, keeping it alive, and making it presentable. Looking after domestic and farm gardens has, through generations of British history, been just as much women's work as men's. In the late 19th and early 20th century, two women gardeners became nationally famous. The first was Gertrude Jekyll, who lived from 1843 to 1932. Born to a wealthy London family, the story of her life challenges the idea that Victorian women were denied opportunity. She went to art school, befriended numerous artists and designers, including John Ruskin, William Morris, and the Pre-Raphaelites, and became a painter and designer. At the age of about 40, her eyesight began to deteriorate. A doctor warned her to give up the work she loved, so she shifted her attention to designing gardens, which she regarded as a legitimate branch of art. In a long and felicitous relationship with the architect Edwin Lutyens, she became Britain's most influential garden designer. The scale of most of their collaborations was far smaller than the great aristocratic projects of William Kent and Capability Brown, sometimes just the private gardens of their middle-class clients. Jekyll, who'd been influenced by the Impressionists, and thought of flowers as comparable to paints, loved bright colours in dense clusters, drifts of one flower offset by sprays of a dramatically different one. She paid close attention to how gardens would smell, as well as how they would look, at different times of the year. Her prolific writing on gardening, including a column in The Guardian and more than 15 books, helped spread her principles widely, mainly in Britain, but also in America, where she gained a loyal following. She also took and developed her own photographs to a high technical standard. Many of her gardens have now disappeared, but a few remain. One of the best places to see Jekyll's work today, side by side with that of Lutyens, is at Hestercombe House in Somerset. The structure of the garden is quite strict, but the plantings are deliberately irregular to soften the impact of the strong shapes. Gardeners there have carefully restored her approach to colour and form. She also designed a walled garden next to Lindisfarne Castle in Northumberland when Lutyens was rebuilding it. This too has been restored in accordance with her designs and creates a bright splash of summer colour, offsetting the gaunt outline of the castle itself. The second of these distinguished women gardeners was Vita Sackville-West, best remembered as a popular novelist and as one of Virginia Woolf's lovers. Sackville-West met Gertrude Jekyll in 1917 and was clearly influenced by her ideas on garden design, which were then at their height. She then went on to do a series of BBC broadcasts on gardening in the 1930s, which made her name well known in gardening circles. Between 1946 and 1961, she wrote a regular gardening column for a Sunday newspaper, The Observer. Although she referred to them as her beastly little articles, they were popular, reprinted in a series of books, and widely influential. Even though she was incomparably richer than nearly all her audience, she realized that most Britons had no more than a little suburban plot where gardening could only be done on a small scale. She wrote with this audience in mind. The finest monument to Sackville-West are the gardens at Sissinghurst Castle, an old Tudor tower in Kent that she bought with her husband, Harold Nicholson. The estate had been badly neglected and was full of junk, scrap iron and weeds. Nevertheless, she wrote, the place when I first saw it on a spring day in 1930 caught instantly at my heart and my imagination. I fell in love at first sight. I saw what might be made of it. It was Sleeping Beauty's castle, a garden crying out for rescue. It was easy to foresee, even then, what a struggle we should have to redeem it. Today, visitors can enjoy the fruits of Vita and Harold's efforts. Sissinghurst has been open to the public since the 1960s, and its gardeners have attempted to preserve her approach to gardening. The beds tend to be crowded with a profusion of plants and flowers, offsetting the disciplined structure with random elements. There should, she wrote, be the strictest formality of design with the maximum informality in planting. This is what we aimed at. Long walkways, north to south and east to west, open up to a semi-concealed small garden area, including the famous White Garden. She favoured wild roses, broad areas with a single colour, but more restraint in colour than Gertrude Jekyll. Her favourite colours were less brilliant, and she liked green flowers. The gardens and estates I've mentioned so far are all in England, but there are plenty to see in Scotland and Wales too. The challenge to Scottish gardeners is the combination of acidic soils, high rainfall and low temperatures. But an offsetting opportunity comes with the very long summer days. The Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh has responded by specialising in hardy plants from temperate latitudes. It includes an alpine garden featuring resilient plants from high altitudes that can grow in rocky ground, and a Chinese hillside garden built around a waterfall. Accompanied by a traditional Chinese building and a colourful assortment of rhododendrons. Edinburgh also has an array of glass houses comparable to those at Kew in London, in one of which you can see immense Victoria water lilies from the Amazon, sometimes 7 or 8 feet across, like immense plates or trays. The Edinburgh Arboretum on site includes hundreds of distinct tree species from around the world. Further north, at Pitt Meadon, near Aberdeen, stands a garden that combines geometrically rigorous parterres with a slightly French feeling and wild herbaceous borders that feel more domestic. Carefully cut boxwood hedges spell out Latin phrases and depict heraldic Scottish mottos and devices. In continuous use at least since 1675, the garden is surrounded by high walls to offer protection from the area's harsh winter winds. Fruit vines are trained to grow against these walls, including gooseberries and red currants. Pitt Meadon also exhibits careful topiary on its yew and beech hedges, while the ground has been modified to create high points that overlook the main garden areas. Far smaller in scale, but delightful, is the garden at J.M. Barry's birthplace, a weaver's house in Kirriemuir near Dundee. Barry was the author of Peter Pan. Beside the house stands a statue of Peter, based on the author's older brother, who died in childhood. He really was a boy who never grew up. There's also a living crocodile made out of undulating willow saplings that children can climb through. Childhood is the theme of the entire garden. Wales, as much as Scotland, has many outstanding gardens. Conwy, which is home to one of the country's best castles, is also the site of Bodnant, whose gardens have the Snowdon mountain range as their background. A wealthy Victorian scientist and businessman named Henry Pochin imported exotic species from all over the world and experimented with crossbreeding to create new subspecies of rhododendron and magnolias. He arranged seasonal surges of colour, including daffodils in April and bluebells in May. Bodnant's most striking feature is an avenue formed by the overhanging branches of laburnum trees. When they're in flower during late May and early June, the whole thing becomes a brilliant yellow tunnel. Wales's National Botanic Garden is in a remote part of Carmarthenshire, northwest of Swansea. It's only been there since 2000, but is popular because of its dramatic domed glass house, built by Norman Foster, which is the largest span of its kind in the world, 360 feet across. Mediterranean plants grow inside. Outside is a wide variety of exhibits that are equally educational and beautiful. The garden has an explicit mission to encourage ecological awareness and botanical education. It's on the site of a house built in the 1790s, which was one of the first in the world to have indoor plumbing. The owner, William Paxton, engineered the surrounding streams and rivers for maximum practical and aesthetic effect. And the garden has been built around the remains of these innovative waterworks after nearly a century of neglect. If you go to Great Britain between May and September, you'll see gardens big and small everywhere. Householders throughout the kingdom love patches of flowers, or even, for city dwellers, just window boxes. The annual Chelsea Flower Show, held every May, is probably the high point of the year for English gardeners. But you'll find superb little gardens at every college in Oxford and Cambridge, at most corporate headquarters, and even at many of Britain's railway stations. Towns and villages compete for most scenic awards by tending flower baskets and placing clusters of colourful flowers on traffic roundabouts and on patches of unbuilt land. In some places, the idea of smelling the roses is just a metaphor. In the British summer, it's a reality and a pleasure.
Lecture 31, Legacy of the British Empire.
From the early 1600s to the mid-20th century, Britain was a colonial power. Among its possessions were India, Burma, Malaya, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, large parts of Central and Southern Africa, and many Caribbean islands. For a century, Britain was also the most influential foreign power in China. Britons who spent their working lives overseas and in the colonies brought back to Britain interesting objects they had found, influencing British tastes and fashions for more than three centuries. When the empire ended, moreover, many citizens of the former colonies emigrated to Britain. In the second half of the 20th century, it became for the first time a multiracial society. Parts of many British cities are now strongly influenced by their immigrant communities, especially from India, Pakistan, and the West Indies. The maturing of multicultural Britain was symbolised in 2016 when Sadiq Khan, the son of Pakistani Muslim immigrants, was elected Mayor of London. One of the many things that came to England from the Far East was tea, originally from China. You don't have to be in Britain for long before appreciating the nation's collective addiction to tea, which is now entering its fourth century. In fact, tea is so English, it's hard to remember the days when it was an exotic newcomer. Samuel Pepys recorded in his diary in 1660 that he'd tried a strange new infusion from China called tea. That was the decade in which King Charles II's Portuguese wife, Catherine of Braganza, brought it to court and made it fashionable. At first, it was too expensive for any but the upper classes. The volume of imports soon increased. Tea moved down the social scale, and people from all classes convinced themselves that it had medical benefits. Since tea was made with boiling water, at a time when the water supply was usually contaminated, it may have helped reduce the incidence of dysentery and typhoid. Fortnum and Mason on Piccadilly is the place to experience the full ritual of tea time. It's not quite as formal as the Chinese tea ceremony, but it does offer plenty of challenges relating to proper disposition of the cups, saucers, milk jug, sugar bowls, spoons, and cake plates. Waiters will also guide your choice of tea, explaining the proper sipping technique. Lots of the other hotels, such as the Ritz and Brown's Hotel, also offer pricey and elaborate high teas. In addition to the growing popularity of tea, a fashion for Chinese art and objects developed in the 18th century. Probably the most distinctive Chinese building in Britain is the pagoda at Kew Gardens. It was designed by William Chambers, a Scottish merchant who made three visits to China, then returned to Europe to study architecture. He built the pagoda in 1762 for Princess Augusta, the mother of King George III. It's 10 floors high and has projecting roofs at every level. It was originally covered with gilded dragons made of wood. They rotted away in the 19th century, but are now being restored to their former glory. Chambers also published a book of Chinese designs, which influenced other builders of his era. At Lord Verney's Claydon House in Buckinghamshire, a talented woodcarver named Luke Lightfoot created a fanciful Chinese room in the 1760s, elaborately covered in scrolls, towers, screens, bells, Chinese statues, all designed to give the appearance of ivory. It's one of the most striking rooms anywhere in Britain. A later Lord Verney married Florence Nightingale's sister, and Florence herself stayed at the house frequently. China cups, plates and vases also came from China, as the name makes clear. British potters like Wedgwood were quick to adapt Chinese styles for the domestic market. Even today, one of the commonest patterns on cups and plates is the blue and white willow pattern, which features Chinese birds, boats, trees, fences, and